When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Hello, Zero Books readers and viewers. It's me again, Douglas Lane. I'm joined today by Pascal Robert and Jason Miles of the This Is Revolution podcast. What did I get your name wrong?
Robert Pascal.
And Jason Miles. Milis.
It is French. Actually, my last name is French as well.
Jason is the lead singer and guitarist for the metal band Bitter Lake and a podcaster for This Is Revolution. Pascal Robert is an iconoclastic Haitian-American lawyer, a blogger, and writer for the Black Agenda Report and the Huffington Post.
He's also a co-host of This Is Revolution podcast. Right.
You're both on the This Is Revolution podcast, and which is now on Zero Books. So,
And can I say before you go on that I watched this show for a while before you and I like met, Doug. And I always loved the intros you did. I always loved your videos. I always thought you had a really interesting artsy take on everything. So I'm excited to be here.
Well, this is the second time you're like, oh, I don't know, the third or fourth time you're here. I also should have introduced you as Paxton Dixon from the Mothership game,
which that's just fun.
Which people may know about, where the captain is Margaret Thatcher. okay, so. Pascal, yeah. Welcome. We are going to talk about we're going to talk about Adolf Reed and Walter Ben Michaels, but we're also going to just talk about Black radical politics today, and also just
before February too. So that's what's important. We're doing this before February,
right? And I want to start with you because before we started on the live stream, we were talking about your thoughts about Adolf Reed's politics and about how he came out of the Frankfurt School tradition and how he's an interesting Black radical because he really does hew closely to the socialist tradition.
Right. I don't want to say he came out of the Frankfurt School tradition. I think that the Frankfurt School kind of influenced him, particularly maybe the work of Marcuse, Adorno, in terms of analyzing popular culture as well. I'm reading a book of one of his earlier anthologies that talks about the influence of those gentlemen as well. But, I think that one of the reasons that I've appreciated his work is that when I started writing, when I actually started on my own personal blog, one of the first pieces that I wrote that was picked up by an online Black publication, which at that time was the Black Commentator, was a piece that I wrote called The Revenge of the Good Blacks. And the piece, The Revenge of the Good Blacks, was basically a piece talking about how, and this is in like 2007, how, there was a group of Black chattering class commentators who were kind of trying to play the role of racial ventriloquists in a way in which they're trying to separate themselves from, those, undesirable people in the community that are Black, and act as if they are kind of like, the essential voice of kind of warning, the white liberal intelligentsia of what's going on or whatnot. And this is an old trope that exists in Black America. And I was basically talking about how class politics work out within the social stratum of Black life. And how I got acquainted with Adolf is that I read a lot of his older works, and I saw that we were kind of fellow travelers. And I got his email. I emailed him that piece, and he was like, oh, we're basically like, kind of fellow travelers here. So we've had an emailing rapport back and forth. And eventually, I wrote a piece on a critique of Ta-Nehisi Coates that was in Black Agenda Report, and it allowed me to befriend Adolf's son, Torrey Reed, who was also a left academic. Who's a good friend of both mine and Jason's. And Torrey and I became very close friends, and we're close friends to this day. And that one of the best friendship that I admired, also a close friend of Jason. And over the, you know, 5 years plus that Tori and I have been friends, I began to interrogate, you know, the Reed tradition through his son and through my email back and forth with Adolf and see dealing with them with human beings. And then realizing that these guys just happen to benefit from coming from a Black left academic tradition of three generations of Black folk who study Black political life that don't buy into the traditional perceptions that many Black people are socialized to view themselves in terms of collective community, unified ideology, racial nationalism, cultural nationalism, collective self-determination, so on and so forth, that they kind of reject those things. And I think that it's not an accident that they come from traditions where they saw those things work out in real politics. A lot of people don't know that Adolf actually worked in the Maynard Jackson administration right out of his PhD program in Atlanta. And he kind of witnessed watching Black politics work firsthand. So it's not like this is a guy who was just into some theoretical stuff in his mind. And he doesn't come from radical socialist activity in the 60s. He actually has a significant history of that. He doesn't wear it on his sleeve like a lot of people like to do, but he does. It's just not the traditional, like he was not a Panther, he was not a member of the Republic of New Africa, but it was in radical socialist organizing. So that kind of shapes his worldview. So for me, as someone who, as Jason knows, that like my thing with looking at class within Black people comes from my family origin, of my parents are from Haiti, and what better place to see the explosion of Black politics and its internal class contradictions, obfuscate the facility of collaborative efforts in the name of simple Blackness than the Haitian Revolution and the political project that tries to come forth after that.
And your father and your uncles are part of
that. My father has two brothers who studied in the Soviet Union who were Haitian communists. My father was more kind of a race man, kind of like my politics, I'm proud and I'm Black and that's it. But he was a political person as well. But his brothers were very much in the kind of Marxist left tradition. So when one of them came back from the Soviet Union and moved to Canada, a common tradition in my family would have deep political discussions every Sunday. So talking about politics, imperialism, capitalism, the foreign policy, you know, the role of American imperialism, race, was something that was a constant conversation in my household every Sunday, along with dominoes and, you know, Caribbean men screaming pejoratives at each other. You know, so that was kind of a normative thing.
And, you know, Black household, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of charged politics informed a lot of my development of my youth. And I kind of found Adolf and Tore kindred spirits in that they came from a political analysis of Black life that was informed by class, which is much more rare than many who are students who are Black politics would actually realize. It's very rare. It's actually almost kind of sacrilegious to talk about Black politics in that terms in certain halls of academia.
Why do you think it is that people like Adolf Reed are not more fully embraced by? I understand why they're not more fully embraced by the academic left, or even the Black academic left. But what do you think it is that keeps Adolf Reed's politics from reaching kind of a mass Black audience? Why isn't that more definitive of the?
Isn't he kind of the antithesis of Ta-Nehisi Coates? And
I don't think that's why. Because first of all, Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing for white people who read the Atlantic, and are suffering at clubs, you know, for having brunch at like, you know, whatever fancy restaurant in Manhattan, you know. So
a few years ago, my oldest son went off to university. He just graduated, but it was a few years ago. But when we went to the induction ceremony, because you know the Oregon Ducks, so it's the induction ceremony. Everyone got a free copy of Ta-Nehisi Coates' "Between the World and Me."
Are you being serious?
Yeah.
Doug, I mean, listen. You are a good study of left theory and Marxist theory, and you know all of the internal outs of the origins of I'm sure you're familiar with
constantly working on it, but yeah,
Francis, what's your name? The Cultural Cold War by Francis Stoner Saunders, who talks about how certain literature has always been supported by the ruling class to create certain narratives. It's I developed a certain problem with Ta-Nehisi Coates' project early on. Even I was probably one of the first people to write a critique of his work. Is that I realized what his project was, in that Coates was trying to be the validator of the Obama project to the liberal chattering class for Black America. Because before he starts getting into his whole, you know, shouting down socialism and Sanders and all that stuff, regardless of what we think about that project, he starts this cheering, my president is Black and everything is great. And
we were 8 years in power.
It's amazing. You know, that's kind of how he starts, but really this whole like ridiculous kind of like, you know, bless a Paul, we have a Black president. He's just so wonderful, without any kind of critical analysis. And as someone who comes out of, you know, Bruce Dixon, who was my editor at Black Agenda Report, who was kind of someone who was instrumental in my political education, I realized that, you know, Barack Obama was basically the ruling class attempt to usurp Black politics and use it as a foil for neoliberalism. And it was very effective. So I realized Obama for the kind of nefarious politics he was early on, but at the behest of Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford, thanks to them for that. And I started writing very, very directly critiquing Obama. And I recognized Coates' attempt to sell this project at the Atlantic of all places as something that was, you know, an overall bad political reality. And I challenged it in that way. So when I saw him write his piece, you know, The Code of the Streets, which just engaged in this kind of like really racist tropes about Black men, no matter how much their educational pedigree, they have this internal hood drive that takes them back to the streets, that makes them just want to, like, you know, grapple with their internal thug, and you can't beat it. And I was like, this is like the most racist cornball nonsense in the world. And this is the same guy who will tell you how stop and frisk is racist at the same time, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Now he wants you to embrace this dreck, The Code of the Streets. And one of the things that's fascinating about Adolf's works is that Adolf, as well as Toure, who would even further explain this, talks about how racial authentication, or the process of racial authentication, does the devil's work in Black politics. Because what it really does is that it fulfills a certain trope in the minds of the liberal elite that helps them facilitate a race management ideology that always works to their advantage and to the disadvantage of the majority of Black folk. In other words, I think one of the most important aspects of understanding the Reed tradition, you know, which is, you know, Adolf, his dad and his son, is that they are very attuned to the fact that since the rise of Booker T. Washington and very before, that Black people are managed in America through a political mechanism called Black politics to maintain subordination with the collaboration of what in third world studies you would call the comprador elite, or with the collaboration of Black people amongst themselves. And for many Black people who look at Black folk as we all in this together against the white man, it becomes difficult for them to even fathom that this type of oppression necessitates that you have collaborators amongst your rank, like any other oppression, frankly, to help keep its facilitation effectively running. And to answer your question as to why it's difficult for Adolf to get the kind of accolades, even particularly in Black circles, is that he shatters this mythological kind of vindicationist posture of studying Black history as, look, King was wonderful, Du Bois was wonderful, Malcolm was wonderful, as opposed to looking at scrutinizing how these people were used within the overall apparatus of the American ruling class to maintain a certain type of management of African-American society from all class levels. And that, I cannot explain to you how difficult it is for many Black people, maybe you could ask Jason, to fathom that it requires Black internal agents of social management to facilitate the devastation that is harmed by racial, race and capitalism in American society.
Yeah, that all sounds right to me. One thing that I want to go back to in what you said, though, was that you thought Ta-Nehisi Coates was part of a project to help Barack Obama usurp a more radical Black politics when he came.
I wouldn't say it that way. I think to validate the Obama enterprise to the liberal ruling class through the eyes of Ta-Nehisi Coates. In other words, we all love Obama. He's our guy, even though he was actually created by a Robert Rubin, Robert Rubin kind of like laboratory of neoliberalism that has nothing to do with Black people or Black politics.
But you did use the word usurp, and you did mention an alternative Black politics. And so I'm wondering, like, around that time when he came into office, after the economic crisis of 2008, where did you see the most promising Black political movements forming?
I think that there was, it's funny, is that one of the biggest statements and conversations or types of discourse I was hearing from members of the Black left when Obama initially rose to his presidency. I remember Bruce Dixon saying this to me. I later on talked to Cedric Johnson. He actually said it too, how a lot of people believe this. And there was an actual New York Times article with this title, that Barack Obama would mark the end of Black politics.
Yeah, the post-racial era.
Right.
The end of Black, like it being a thing, in general?
Like the way Cedric has a he was talking to me in a kind of like, colloquial way, is that Cedric was mentioning an article he had either written or was reading about, said the end of the Uncle Tom is over. Meaning that there was a time, the Uncle Tom being the kind of stereotypical trope that exists in Black society of the Black person who's subservient to the will of the master, so on and so forth, et cetera, who turns Black folk in. What Cedric is saying is that there was a time when Black people were able to recognize the treachery of the Uncle Tom character. And he's saying that what Obama demonstrated is that the post-racial kind of charade had demonstrated the way in which the ruling class in America were able to curate a Black political figure so effectively that he made Uncle Tom seem hip because he can shoot a basketball and his wife is beautiful and the kids and family are awesome. Now, my position is not to say that, Barack Obama isn't Uncle Tom, though Ajamu Baraka has called him that. My position is that I think that those kind of terms are awkward, old school, and not effective. I think that we should talk about Black politics with the sophistication that it deserves.
So you don't like Cornel West's take on Barack Obama as a Wall Street neoliberal in blackface?
I mean, I think that's an adequate description. I think he is. I think that what Barack Obama demonstrated was the first time neoliberalism took hold of national Black politics in a way in which it made it operational nationally. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama comes to life in a crucible of about four or five Black politicians who are auditioning for that job to be the first Black president for neoliberalism. There was Harold Ford Jr. There was Cory Booker. There was Artur Davis. Adrian Fenty was in that loop. And there was Barack Obama. They were all of them heavy supporters of charter schools, which was the signature subject to be the test measure for being loyal to the neoliberal project in the early aughts in terms of black politics. All of the neoliberal think tanks, Brookings, Manhattan, you name them, were all like, aha, this is the silver bullet, charter schools. We can get the black folk to believe they're actually sending their kids to private schools and gut their public schools at the same time. This is great. So all of those politicians supported that. They all were heavily Wall Street adjacent or financed by Wall Street. They all supported whatever kind of imperial projects the United States was engaged in at the time. So Glenn Ford wrote a very good piece when Cory Booker first ran for mayor that basically exposed what he then called the right-wing hijacking of black politics. It wasn't really a right wing. From Glenn's position, it was right wing because these actors had never financed black political actors like this before. So it was capital. It was actually what he was documenting was the way in which big capital, for the first time since the civil rights era, was recruiting black political figures under a certain agenda, particularly charter schools, with this avarice that he'd never seen before, and that Cory Booker was like high on the list of these figures.
And Pascal, not to cut you off, but to cut you off, the other day on our stream, we had your homie Jeff Kennedy on, who was talking about when Barack Obama had appointed that woman. I can't think of her name off the top of my head.
Michelle Rhee,
and then at the same time, the Waiting for Superman doc comes out, which is just totally the most pro-charter school propaganda.
I don't know if you guys remember. Do you understand how propagandized in terms of corporate media some of these guys were? Like Cory, but do you understand how much media was behind Cory? I
mean, he's in the 13th documentary.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, this guy was mayor of Newark. We've had mayors of Newark going back to the 70s. But this guy had all, there was like a whole almost kind of like MGM film about Cory Booker's mayoralty. I mean, all of this gloss was shown on these guys. And what Glenn Ford is saying in his piece eloquently is that the American ruling class had come to a point where they realize that using racial diversity to democratize the neoliberal project was their way to take capitalism into the 21st century. Mm.
So I want to go back to the question I asked you, Pascal, but asked Jason, and in maybe a little different way. But back in 2008, there was a big economic crisis. It really started in 2007. Barack Obama inherited the biggest financial and economic crisis of my lifetime, probably the biggest one since the Great Depression. Yeah, and I mean, you weren't alone. What I noted at the time, I mean, I wasn't focused on black politics, but just no, I mean, I was looking at the left in general. So I did. Yeah. I was reading Black Agenda Report back then, but I wasn't only thinking about black politics. And what I noticed is that there wasn't much except for the Black Agenda Report and a few other like Ted Rall maybe was critical, and there were a few others.
Oh, critical. No one was critical of Obama that I knew about other than Black Agenda Report.
Right. But well, yeah, on the left, there was very few voices that were critical of Barack Obama, and there are very few voices that were trying to push a radical response to the economic crisis of 2008. And you know, that's how I came to Marxism, was realizing I didn't have a left politics that could cope with the reality of that moment. Like I had to start. I started a podcast. I started interviewing economists, left economists of various types, as well as a whole bunch of other freaks, including psychedelic warriors and science fiction authors.
I did something quite different. I took a Greyhound bus to Louisiana and worked in the Gulf of Mexico because I lost everything.
Well, yeah, I was working at Comcast and didn't lose my job that year, but a few years later. But and then I was lucky because I got on unemployment for a while because it was good for everybody. But in any case, the point here is what do you guys think at that moment Black radical politics might have done to intervene differently? And I mean, I guess it would have had to start with rejecting the Obama agenda, but where would it have gone from there?
I feel like we always, and me, Pascal, Teray, Cedric, and I always talk about like where Black politics was, especially in the 90s. Wouldn't you agree with this, Pascal?
Yeah.
And it was so different to even where it is now. And if you think about getting through the law and order rhetoric of lock 'em up shit coming from the mouths of Black people from the 90s mm-hmm. into the 2000s, where a lot of Black people like myself made some good money. I was making a few hundred thousand dollars a year before the market took everything away. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I understood the hope that people had to a certain degree, but there just was never anything substantive behind it. And I just don't think there was a Black politic that was going to challenge. I mean, Cornel West at one point in time was campaigning for Barack Obama.
Right. I mean, let's make this clear. I mean, one of the reasons why Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford come out so hard against Obama is that Bruce Dixon was literally training Barack Obama as a community organizer in Chicago and saw this guy come out of the laboratory, you know, and literally was like, this guy was foundation hatched. Like at a certain point, I came to realize like, oh man,
And Torrey talks about this in his book, how there's like this projection people have on Barack Obama that he's just like, well, he had a single mother. It's like for a minute, I mean, yeah, I had a single mom.
Yeah, it was a very elaborated kind of, you know, very much exaggerated narrative to try to make him the everything man for what people could believe as like the downtrodden Black man, and you know.
Right. So to answer your question, Doug, I don't really think. Sorry to cut Pascal. I'm just going to stop cutting you the fuck off.
Go ahead.
but real talk. There was outside a Black Agenda report, which kind of does exist as a bit of a minority, even in Black left politics, because they do call out people like Barack Obama.
Right.
There wasn't a voice to say anything to what he was doing or not doing for that matter. Right. Because we didn't get the home loan bailout that we were supposed to get. All those programs that were supposed to be rolled out to help homeowners didn't happen. We saw the loss of more Black wealth during the Obama 8 years than at any other time in history. So what does that say about the quote unquote left and Black left at that point in time? It's we talk about it all the time. The shit ain't there. That's why we do our That's why we do our show. And maybe that's why we get so angry. I mean, look, Doug, I'll be honest with you and everybody that's watching this show, and maybe my daddy is watching. I don't know, but we get into it over Barack Obama. I go to his house and he's got a picture of, and it's like Obama and fucking Bob Marley and Malcolm X. I'm like, I don't know what any of these motherfuckers got to do with one another. And definitely, what has Barack Obama ever given you?
Like, I'll be very frank, right? Mm-hmm. There was a time where I used to be profoundly motivated by contempt for Obama
mm-hmm.
and what he represented. I'm actually, mm-hmm. I've gotten over it, right? Because I just feel that he's so transparently just shallow and control. Like I look at Obama as a lab experiment. Like, you know, he's just something that was, I wrote a piece called Barack Obama, Wall Street's Perfect Manchurian Candidate.
Mm.
I fell in a video of Barack Obama at the Brookings Institute in 2006, mm-hmm. sitting in front of Robert Rubin and applauding the opening of Robert Rubin's Hamilton project. He was the only senator there. Why would he choose the neophyte senator to be at this big time, big, all these Wall Street people there? And he's like, yes, we all agree at markets and blah, blah, blah. And when people saw that video, they were horrified. they're like, oh my God, he's like, these guys are the devils. How are they out there just saying he agrees with these people like that? I was like, these people made him.
Thank you.
They manufactured this guy.
And he's and you know what? If you go back, if you watch any interview he does now, you totally understand why people still effing love this dude. Like I watched that interview he did on David Letterman when David on David Letterman's
on Netflix. On the Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah. And you watch it and you're like, you know, he's so kind of casually, cavalierly talks about.
He's never had anyone really challenge him. He's never had a journalist of integrity come from oppositional politics, challenge him on his record. Effectively, he would never be interviewed. Glenn Ford would never agree to be interviewed by Barack Obama.
They'll never let that interview happen. Either he was getting challenged on the right, because I at this time during the Obama presidency, I was living with a family that was not my own, that I think I've told you about, Doug, that is was a Christian conservative, actually white family, and they watched a decent amount of Fox News. So I saw all the terrorist fist bumps. I saw the, oh my God, this N-word's in a tan suit. Like, that critique of him was just so silly and cartoonish, and was never a critique on the politics or policies.
It created an effective means to silence black critique on any left. It didn't have to be left. Any critique of Obama, he was like, the white people want to get him. The racists are coming for him. The racists are coming for him.
Right, and we were supposed to defend Obama.
And part.
I want to interject if I can, because the other thing to remember about Obama was that when he ran, he was running against the coronation of Hillary Clinton. Yeah. And he was perceived to be the left alternative to
Hillary
Clinton. Yeah, remember he always talked about how socialist he wasn't.
Yeah, I know, but nonetheless, people projected a lot onto him and his black skin, and they
same things going on with Kamala Harris, right?
Well, I don't think it's as effective with Kamala Harris, but
she doesn't have the academic bona fides. I
mean, that's one thing about Obama, is he was legitimately and is still legitimately a charismatic guy. He really is a good communicator. He really he does come across like somebody who not only would you like to know,
he had a lot of the political skills that make the sell well.
Yeah,
on his own.
Yeah. Remember 2004 when he gives the speech?
Oh, yeah, that's what he did.
Everybody lost their shit. To my point of this guy.
I hated that speech, because that was going on in the middle of the Bush administration, where we had just started in two illegal wars. And to say there was not a left America and a right America, or a red America and a blue America, but just one America unified, meant to me like we're all unified behind this imperialist project around the world, and the loss of our civil liberties, and we're all just going to program. And so I thought, I didn't like Obama from the very first time I saw him, even though I could see that it was an effective speech. But in 2008, he was a charismatic figure of the left, and people projected that a lot of hope onto him. I mean, that was his campaign slogan, but also they really did think he was going to come in and be the new FDR. People on the left.
I mean, Chris Matthews was talking about, he's going to be the new FDR. I was like,
that's the same language we hear about Joe Biden.
You guys remember that WikiLeaks exposed that book?
I'm sorry.
Do you think that Sanders was more of legitimately what we people wanted Obama to be? And like, or were we? I mean, he talked a better talk, but were we taken for a ride with the Sanders campaign? Is what I'm asking.
Taken for a ride in the sense that he wasn't authentic, or taken for a ride in what sense?
Taken for a ride in so much as that he didn't have the aim to win. Maybe.
I think I agree with that. I believe that Sanders never believed he was going to become president of the United States. I'm sorry, I'm going to crush people's dreams. I think that Sanders always knew. Listen, Bernie Sanders has been involved in American politics well enough to understand how the primary system works. He understands why Jim Clyburn has a network of black voters through churches and social mechanisms that he can, at his behest, ensure who's going to win South Carolina. He understands why certain states are scheduled at a certain point in the primary. I don't believe at any time, I'm sorry, I don't believe Bernie Sanders at any time believed that he was going to win the Democratic primary or be allowed to be president of the United States. I think that Bernie Sanders' project, which is not an ignoble project, I think it has a valuable project. I think Bernie Sanders' project was about interjecting what, in the context of American politics, was a hard left. In the context of American politics, was considered a hard left agenda to fracture the neoliberal bipartisan consensus in the politics in the country. Period.
I think he thought he could win.
I don't believe that.
I think so. Because he was winning
the first three states. After the first three states, maybe everybody thought he could win for a moment there. But
that was a huge consolidation of power.
Bernie Sanders knew he was not going to be president without black voters, period. I'm sorry. He knew it.
And he didn't have the ability to get black voters.
No, because the black political, and this is what no one will tell you, because the black political machine was dispatched to make sure he didn't get them.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And you really saw it when Breonna Joy Gray would go on any sort of black show. They beat the shit out of that girl on any black show.
I'm talking about, it's not even, we don't even have to get conspiratorial.
I'm not even getting conspiratorial. I'm just telling you what I saw.
I don't disagree with you. What I'm saying is that no one wants to talk about the way in which black electoral politics is a cartel system. James Clyburn has connections with the black churches.
Yes.
The black, historically black colleges and universities.
Yes.
The black social networks, the black membership organizations, the black Masonic lodges. He has connections with all of them. He spends the majority of his time as congressman from South Carolina extracting patronage from the Democratic Party, from Big Pharma, and doing constituent services from all those voters so they know that when it's time for the Democratic primary in South Carolina, when Clyburn says this is where we go, this is where we go. And that's how black politics works. I challenge any political scientist to deny that.
But Clyburn actually does get results for his constituents, though. We were talking about that earlier today.
He does constituent services,
We were talking about that earlier. Like that's a reason why he's able to make that shit move. It's not like he just goes up to a bunch of silly Negroes and says, vote for this guy.
Bernie Sanders never had any entree into the social mechanisms necessary to turn black voters out to have him win those primaries.
What would he have needed, though?
He would needed the patronage to get those people to agree to leave the traditional neoliberal Democrats for him.
He had Cardi B.
No, that's not going to work. Black politics is a class politics, and it's a patronage politics.
Yeah.
You gotta be able to guarantee black media figures how many contracts am I getting for the next four election cycles from your people for interviews to make sure we're gonna say, okay, this is Bernie Sanders, y'all. Y'all gave us some love.
But that kind
of story is not romantic, that's the reality.
How do we get real? Okay, if you're saying that. And we're all acknowledging the fact that Barack Obama has never been a true progressive leftist, whatever word you want to use. And if the black vote is that important, how are we ever going to get that black vote?
I never said the black vote is important or not. But I'm saying it's carteled to protect.
How do we infiltrate the cartel of the racial ventriloquism? Sorry, Doug.
You said it was important. You said no. It's okay. You said it was important when in the primary system
to get. How do we infiltrate the cartel? How do we infiltrate that cartel of racial ventriloquists and call that shit out? Like, how do we?
This is the crisis of black politics. This is what my book is about. This is the problem. This is why
I'm out of zero.
I'm
fucking around. I'm gonna stop.
This is why on the electoral level, why black politics doesn't work for black people. And this is why black politics is a class politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And this is the problem. And you know, we talk about this all the time, Pascal, with Teray and even you and I back and forth. We joke about all the time. We call each other in the AM before a show we do, our live stream, and we have a regular conversation that friends would have, and then it always drifts off into a political conversation. This is kind of part of our conversation we always have is the the myth of a black politic and who's pulling the strings and racial ventriloquism.
Well, Doug, how did you guys Doug, get together to do the show before? How did you guys end up doing the show together?
Torrey Reed.
Torrey put us together. He Torrey was friends with each one of us. And he
Let's
said,
be that. Honest, Torrey. Yeah. And then it was all downhill from there.
No. So, okay. So, but did Jason, had you started This Revolution on your own? And then,
Yeah, that's all right. Me. That's all me. And then Torrey was like, hey, I got a friend. And then that was, those two were going to come on the show for a live stream. And we were going to talk about one of the things that I think this show, what we're talking about kind of is about, is the problematic nature of Boys in the Hood. Because
right, that's what we did, right?
When we talk about black politics, when we talk about, and a lot of it came from me being frustrated at hearing black people, you know, I don't want to vote for Joe Biden because that's the 94 crime bill. It's like, I get that, but do you remember 92?
Well, one of the things for me, and Jason and I had several conversations about this, was that one of the things that we had started to notice, and I am a consumer of a lot of the left podcast media, not as much as Jason perhaps, but I've been watching a lot of it, is that I felt that these folks would only dispatch black voices who could discredit aspects of black politics they didn't like, and they weren't legitimately interested in how black politics actually worked or how it could be changed to make forth a progressive politics for everyone.
Would you name names in the parrot room after? Would you name some names?
I don't think it's that deep. I think it's
just for the patrons only. You can say which of these folks are dispatching black voices just to discredit the aspects of the politics they don't like, but not like giving them a full voice. I just want to wrap people up before we get started with this.
It could be me, right? I've been guilty of this as well, in that like it's just this.
Don't name names to the next.
The reality, the reality of the racial ventriloquist charade, right? Mm-hmm. Let's be very candid here. Is that white media summon you when they want you to explain something about black people to them? Okay. Mm-hmm. Usually, it's because there's something about black people they don't understand, or something about black people that they don't like, that they want you to explain why it's bad for mm-hmm. them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not to toot my own horn, but I've been talking to Margaret Kimberly from the Black Agenda Report off and on for years. And when I bring her on, and it's always been the case when I bring her on, it's not because I want her to explain black politics to me or black people to me, but because I feel like she's smarter than I am, and she had some insight into the overall left or the overall problem that we're facing.
Margaret Kimberly is one of those people who's not, I would never call her a racial ventriloquist. I don't think most of the black left you're going to find, I don't think that they are racial ventriloquists. What I do find is that oftentimes they're called upon to talk about, you know,
the
discrediting
black
phenomenon in black politics or black spaces, without asking, well, why exactly is this in the first place? Or trying to really, like, I'm going to be very candid with you. I found that many of the Sanders supporters were befuddled as to why, for some reason, black people didn't just naturally understand why Bernie Sanders was better for them than Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. And why wouldn't they just support Bernie? I mean, he has better materialist politics. I don't get it. What is this about? In sport of asking, why does this guy who comes from a state that's alabaster like Vermont even expect black people to trust him to have a politics that they can work for them?
Wouldn't the average person, average black voter, average working class voter, look at Bernie Sanders and say some of the same things that Bernie Sanders' biggest detractors said, which is, this is a guy who's sounded good for 40 years but hasn't done very much?
Can I tell you something that actually happened to me when we were still doing the show in studio in West Oakland? I had a show that I was doing with a very good friend of mine that's a comedian, and he would bring in other comedians and they'd do comedian shit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it would get political. And Bernie Sanders' name came up, and one of his comedian friends was like, I don't trust him. He's not for reparations. That, and I was like, okay, so what? So my first thing was, I said, so what would you want? I'm not making this shit up. You can find it. I forget what episode it is, but you can find it. And she goes, free college. What else would you want? Healthcare. Okay, isn't that all part of his platform? And it was that kind of like.
Now I will say this: the racial ventriloquists of the liberal media, they can't. They did Bernie Sanders very dirty. They did him dirty. I'll be very frank with you, Doug. I will say this about Bernie Sanders: regardless of whether or not I thought he could win, I do believe the American ruling class thought he was the most dangerous candidate running for president in both 2016 and 2020. Yep. That is without a doubt to me. Yep. Because it was very, very unseemly to some of these Exeter and Andover third generationists seeing their kids talking about, Dad, I'm a socialist now. Bernie is the way.
He did that. He did 2016. Let's not lie. Twitter is filled with these Bernie socialists.
Yeah, during the first three primaries, you could watch the mainstream liberal media like MSNBC and CNN vilify Bernie in a way that was equal to or even surpassed the way they were vilifying Trump. And I think I don't remember which commentator, but someone said, you know, if it's Bernie Sanders versus Trump, I guess I'll have to vote for Trump.
Chris Matthews, right?
I think it was Chris Matthews.
Was it Matthews or Scarborough?
I think it was Scarborough.
Well, Chris Matthews
said, I'm afraid Sanders and his supporters are going to drag me into Central Park.
Yeah.
What have you done, Chris? What are you feeling guilty about? But anyway,
it was obnoxious. And there were many voices, many black voices on MSNBC. Many black voices who tried to portray Bernie Sanders, who marched in the civil rights movement, as this most ridiculously cartoonish racist guy compared to what? Hillary Clinton?
Hillary. I was a gold water girl.
Yeah.
She was a gold water girl. Also, my husband drafted the crime bill, Clinton.
But see what we're doing right now?
We're going full Bernie. Shout out to Haiti in my back pocket, Clinton. Hillary.
You know what it is, Doug? It was frustrating for my opinion. This is going to be different than Pascal's. It was frustrating for me to see the discourse around Bernie Sanders and black people and all this talk about reparations that just popped out. It felt like it popped out of nowhere. I was like, I never heard Barack Obama say shit about a motherfucking reparation. He didn't say shit about mass incarceration. I think his light skinned ass didn't even walk into a jail until his the final year of his last term. So I never understood why there was such this like, no, fuck this. It's 80-year-old white guy. We don't want him as president.
He partially thanked Ta-Nehisi Coates for starting that discourse.
He did start that shit.
What do you guys think about reparations?
I think it's a morally justifiable idea. I think politically, unless you have the politics to make it so, it's a dream. And I think that it's the ultimate way in which the ruling class can create a solution for black politics while maintaining the traditional paradigm of creating something for the black elites and very little for black poor and working class people. So in other words, as Tory would like to say, it'll be a kind of means tested program for poor black folk, and it'll be black capitalism or set aside programs for black elites.
I mean, yeah, this is my fear. If you had reparations actually go through, is that what you would find? It would be a meager, it wouldn't really lift the majority of black people out of poverty. It would be some sort of meager kind of gesture for most people. And then the other thing that would happen after you passed reparations is something, if it was at all consequential, if people felt it at all, and even if they didn't, you would have a lot of I think there would be a coalition of people who would say things like, okay, now there goes affirmative action.
No, there would be massive blowback. There was blowback after this Somalia affirmative action. I mean, look at Baki. Baki was in like 73, the Baki decision. I mean, the blowback from any even seeming reparations would be real. One of my things is that, again, I think reparations is rhetorically justified, but it does not address the reality that in an American capitalist society, Black people are disproportionately rendered to the reserve labor of army, the reserve army of labor, to facilitate the functionality of capitalism for the majority of the American populace. We have the national rate of unemployment, as Milton Friedman called it, for a reason, or as there's the fancy algorithm for the NAIRU, which is a normal rate of unemployment that is necessary to maintain the functioning of capitalism in America, that we know is hyper-racialized, just like capitalism is done so to allow the illusion in the minds of most whites who make up the majority of poor people per capita in this country, that the system still works for them. I don't see how reparations deny that. And I defy Sandy Darity, who admitted on social media, and I saw him do it, that you would need a federal jobs guarantee to stop that from happening. Oh, so now you're admitting that your reparations plan without a federal jobs guarantee is worthless.
It's bullshit. Somebody said they hoped Breonna would help with the Black vote. Can we talk about Breonna Joy Gray and the Black vote?
Maybe save it for the Parrot Room if we're going to start trashing
people. Yeah. Well, it's not. It's a very honest critique.
Okay. Well, I'll let you get to it, but I want to ask a question about Walter Ben Michael, since he's also on the thumbnail. Mm-hmm. And here's how I'll do that. Walter sometimes says that the class politics of anti-racism can be seen if you just imagine American society overcoming racism without overcoming class, and that this is actually the vision of the kind of, let's say, mainstream academic woke anti-racist agenda. Is like, we will have parity between the races. That means the same number of white people will be impoverished as Black people, the same number of white people and Asian people and all so forth will be will die prematurely or injured on the job or unemployed. And so you wouldn't have disparity between the races, but you also would, but you would still hold on to that basic disparity between the classes and a power.
And you would also have a more Hunger Games esque type society.
Yeah.
Do you think that vision for a post-racial America or post-racial globe is possible to achieve with the under capitalism, that we could actually live in a world like that? Or do you think that
I think that race has to
be deployed somewhere or another in order to justify?
I think that there would be rebellion that would require military or actual martial suppression. That, in other words, people, I think that I'll be very frank with you. When that will be implemented, the rebellion will come from the right, not from the left.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's already happening in a way, because you're seeing a decline in the lifespan, for instance, of the average American white male.
Right. Have you guys ever been in an implicit bias seminar to the anti-racism point? I feel like I got in a lot of trouble for speaking up during the implicit bias the seminar I had working actually at a homeless shelter, of all places, because it always boiled down to, like you said, the parity of races and people yelling out things like, well, the problem is we don't have enough Black management. My first thing is like, well, what if the Black manager is an asshole, just like the white guy? So is Black management the problem, or is assholes a problem? We had a Black president. We had a Black DOJ. We have Black mayors. We have Black police chiefs. We have a lot of Black shit,
but
Black cops shooting Black kids.
But what you said, Pascal, I want to go back to. You said that if that ever really was tried to, if you ever tried to accomplish that, it would require kind of a military state to control the population. And in other words, the way you got it now with this myth of representation for at least whites in the country is what keeps them quiescent. And if you don't have that racial dynamic, you're going to see unrest. And then if you and if when it starts to go away, you're going to see right wing reaction. Is that what you?
Yes.
Understand? Yeah,
absolutely.
Do you think this the Capitol storming is some of that right wing reaction, Pascal?
I don't think that that necessarily. I think that that can happen. I think Trump is the first political manifestation of a politics that could take us there. And the test that we have to see is whether and how married the Democrats or the liberals are to that neoliberal vision. And I think they could be very much married to it.
Well, I'll say something wild as a science fiction writer. I can imagine within 50 to 100 years that the world will have been transformed enough through war that rather than Europe and America being sitting on top of the world, you've got Africa and China sitting on top of a capitalist empire. That, you know, it's possible. I don't think that these categories are geographically or racially are actually fixed. It's just a matter of how the history plays out. But I wouldn't want to get there, actually. I'd rather get to a world where we're united and around class and basically, transcend class rather than see capitalism work itself out so that everyone changes seats, you know.
Zero Books plug right here. I am reading Michael Harris's book about the Hunger Games.
Oh, yeah.
And it definitely speaks to some of what you're talking about. So. Very good.
Well, we've been going for 56 minutes. You guys, is there anything you guys didn't get to talk about that you want to? I mean, Pascal, you got to come back on maybe with me just on your own. No offense, Jason, because you're come back on just on your own as well. But I want to talk to you about, I want to talk to you more about E.L. Fried, and I'm interested to know if you might be able to inform me about how the Frankfurt School informed that kind of Cedric Johnson and Adolf Reed's politics and how you think it.
Why don't we just get you to talk to Adolf?
Well, I've emailed him a couple times. He never answers me back.
I would try to facilitate that.
Do you think that's
what do you think, Pascal?
Well, let's have the conversation off stream. Yeah, I mean, for the Parrot Room, I'll tell you about another left intellectual who now is no longer returning my emails, and I'll complain and bitch and moan.
Is this who we were talking about earlier today?
It might be. I can't remember. I have no memory anymore. But both you guys, you're going to come back in about 10 minutes and do another round. Are you good with that, Pascal?
Jason? I'm good with that.
Yeah, we set it aside. I mean, my 2-year-old isn't going to come in here, so we're all good.
So Gene Bajelan might join us. So we'll have four.
Oh, dope. Gene. Yeah. So, Doug, we did a show since we got like 2 minutes. We did a show, me, Pascal, Gene Bajelan, Derek Varn, and Dan Larson of Toy Galaxy. And we went on for like 2.5 hours. That shit was dope.
Cool. Right. Well, I'm gonna run the out trailer now because I'm lazy and I'm gonna not give people the last 2 minutes. And then in about 10 minutes,
that's dirty pool, Lane. Dirty pool.
I'm old. I'm old.
You and Pascal are the same age.
Is that right? Did you just turn?
Yeah, I was born 68.
Oh, so you're a little older than I am. Even I was born in 70.
So
well, that's not my intent. So anyway, we'll go out on the out here, and then we'll talk in about 10-15 minutes. Okay, on the Patreon.
Sounds good. Right.
The material relations between people becomes social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and